Okay, great.
So okay, cool.
Just in case, I want to have both of them.
Yep.
The good thing with Zencastr is it provides an audio for mine and audio for yours. So it's easier to do post on this.
Yeah.
Whereas Zoom is just one file, so it's much harder. Yeah. Okay, I think we are ready to go. So basically the idea is we want to record for about an hour or something along those lines. There are three segments, and I will, it's like 20 minutes each segment. It's okay if we go like 5 minutes over on top of each. It doesn't matter. Not too much on top because we still want to keep the whole podcast within an hour-ish. So yep. I will run a stopwatch as well. And when we have 5 minutes remaining in each segment, I'll show you 5 minutes kind of thing. Okay, cool. Yeah, I don't think there's anything I need to ask you. Yeah, okay, let's go.
All right.
And okay, do not laugh this time. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
All right, here we go. And welcome to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I'm your host, Nick Arora, and we have in store another interview with us today. Today we have Mike with us, who's going to tell us about some fancy computing techniques that can help not only the field of astronomy, but other places like medical physics as well. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Yeah, it's nice here in London right now. How are you doing?
I'm great too. So I should tell my readers that Mike is actually joining us from the UK. He's based in UK. And that actually gives me a good sort of segue to introduce Mike a little bit as well. So Mike is a good friend of mine, and you'll see why that is in a minute. He's currently a final year PhD student at University of Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom. Mike focuses on machine learning, and I can maybe venture to go as far as artificial intelligence, and applies those to various fields of physics. Mike was originally from Hertfordshire in the UK as well, but is part Irish. He likes to point out that he has a high Irish passport. yeah, he spent about 2 years, if I'm not wrong, maybe three here at Kingston, at Queen's University as a visiting student, working with our group, which is where we sort of got to collaborate a little bit, and we'll talk about some of those collaborations in later in this podcast. He's also associated with the Alan Turing Institute in the UK as well, and that's where we will also talk a little bit about his work there as well. But let's start with some introductory questions, Mike. It's great to have you here. Let's start with what got you interested into physics and then on to astrophysics.
Okay, yeah. So I was always interested in maths and anything you could do experiments with. And physics is quite an experimental science. So you can play around with your hands a lot. You can do things and see what happens. And that's physics. I like the experimental side for sure. That's the main thing. And I was actually decent at it, which was quite nice.
That's always the goal. Yeah, decent at positive. It.
Yeah. And astrophysics was actually a happy accident because I went into my master's degree not having done any astrophysics at all.
Mm.
And I was doing medical physics with machine learning, artificial intelligence on the side. But there's not a lot of data in medical physics, and for machine learning, you need lots and lots of data. And it just so happens that astrophysics has lots of data to spare, which is how I ended up going into astrophysics too.
Right. Huh. Very interesting. Yeah, I think it's very interesting to see sort of the connections that various fields of physics have, and how if you sort of understand the core of it, you can really just move from field to field with relatively easy transformations or transitions, if you had care to elaborate a little bit on that as well.
Once you know the background, once you know the maths and like the general physics of physics, easily transfer into other areas. And it's not just physics as well. Once you know like how to do maths and computer science and right. coding. It's all transferable skills, which you would learn in a physics degree. So you could take these skills once you graduate and go off and do, I don't know, banking or anything you need to use maths for. I think it's a very versatile degree to have as a physics degree, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the quote of Sheldon Cooper from The Big Bang Theory comes to mind.
Yeah.
A physicist understands the basic know-how do's of the whole universe.
Yeah.
I think that's quite true. It's once you understand sort of those basics, it's not that hard to transition from one place to another. If you don't mind me asking and going further on sort of your love for coding before we really dive into machine learning, how long have you been coding? What was that sort of introductory period and start period into coding was like? Because as far as I know, and I think most people will share this experience with me, that coding is not that common in high school, right? You don't get into Python. Now there are crash courses all over the internet, but sort of as a core curriculum, you don't easily get into that through your high school. You generally have to sort of branch away. So do you want to?
Yeah, so that's very true. Especially when me and you were kids, I think maybe it's changed a little bit now.
Yeah, a little
bit. When I was younger, there was no coding in high school. The most we did we called it IT back then, was using PowerPoint and Word, and that was the IT course. And no coding. So I had to go off by myself and learn it myself. And the thing that actually made me learn it was I used to have this really old laptop computer from it was 10 years old. And it couldn't run Windows anymore. So I went off and I was like, oh, how can I make this fast again? And I found this thing called Linux. And I installed it. And suddenly it was fast. I was like, oh, wow, it's fast. What else can I do? And I started digging into the hardware and the software. And I learned what coding was that way. From hacking around with hardware.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, I think for our listeners over here, definitely try to move into Linux. It looks like a very archaic operating system from the looks of it, but it is fabulous to work with, for sure. No matter what you're doing, Linux has a space for anyone, and the added advantage being it's completely open source, so it's free to install on computers. Yeah. All right, so let's move to machine learning from coding. So what you apply machine learning to physics, but before we get into that, could you give us sort of the bottom shelf definition, the easiest cookies to reach, about what machine learning is? And another thing I saw as your interest was deep learning, and how is it different from deep learning?
Okay, so machine learning, I'd like to explain it as what you're doing is you're giving the computer a problem. So you're saying classify these pictures between dogs and cats. If you have a big pile of dog and cat pictures, you're saying just classify them. You know nothing else about the problem. Whereas if you're just coding, you'd have to explicitly define what a dog is and what a cat is. With machine learning, you can tell the computer, learn what a dog, what a cat is, and then classify them. So it's much less hands-off, much more hands-off, less hands-on.
Right.
So you're just giving it a general instruction. You're saying, go do it. With normal coding, you have to define each step.
Right.
And deep learning is a subset. It's a branch of machine learning. It's specifically to do with neural networks, which is just a type of machine learning. And it's a type that's got very popular recently because it seems to work very well with big data sets. And so deep learning is neural networks. Machine learning is saying to the computer, go away and do this stuff and don't talk so much to me.
So you're basically giving a lot of independence to the computer. And to some extent, it's understanding complex patterns, right?
Yeah.
Of course, when we have to define, let's say, a dog in words, right? We have to be able to use a lot more words. Whereas for a code, maybe you're saying, I don't care what you define as a dog, it might be different from my definition till the time you sort of give me a similar end result. Is that correct to sort of put it that way?
Yeah, that's completely right. So you would say go and define a dog. You don't care how it defines it.
Yeah.
Does its own thing. It can be completely different to how you would define it. As long as it gets the same result, that's what you care about. You just care about it being correct. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Cool. So, all right. So let's get started a little bit on sort of your interest in machine learning. What do your interests in machine learning look like? What started this whole journey of being a doctoral student here of using physics and machine learning together?
So yeah, like I said, I started doing machine learning in my master's year, in my undergrad course, which was 2017 now. And the thing that really sealed it for me is we might talk a little bit about this later, but I'll just go over it quickly now. We have this problem where we have to classify ECG scans, like heartbeat scans. And we had a bunch of these scans, and I was given the task to go away and classify them all, like between healthy and ill patients. And these scans, it was a typical ECG. But when the bed moves, because the bed moves when the patient heart beats, we had some noise at the end of the scan, which is weird. And I defined this machine learning algorithm, and I said, look at all these scans and classify these patients. And it did fairly well. It could classify them correctly. But then I looked at which parts of the scan were diagnostic, which parts told us whether the patient was ill or healthy. And it turns out the noisy bit of the bed was diagnostic. So the noise meant something. It could tell you if the patient was ill or healthy. And I went to my supervisor at the time, Ben Varco. And it turns out there's this thing called a ballistocardiogram, which is vibrations caused by your heart. And it turns out the thing that we thought was noise was actually diagnostic. And that's something we never would have found out if we didn't do machine learning on it. Now, the thing that really sealed the deal for me was saying, I can find out things I don't even know about, and I have no expertise in just by applying machine learning to these problems. That's what got me into it. Yeah.
That's really interesting that you were able to sort of get these vibrations or movement of the bed from a human heartbeat. Could you sort of tell our audience over here what level of signal this is? Because presumably the bed does not move a lot when your heart beats, right? So what level of signal are we looking at here?
So it's we use these really sensitive magnetometers, so these very sensitive magnets, and they could pick up the heartbeat because as the bed moved, there were actually quite strong signals about the same amplitude as the middle bit of the heart. You know, when you see the heartbeat go, it goes beep, 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 the big tool bit. So they're very, very prominent, actually. And you could definitely see them because we're using these very sensitive magnets to pick up the ECG, MCG of the heart. So you could, yeah, for sure.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So what kind of techniques are sort of it's a little crass to put it this way, but what kind of techniques are sort of your favorite?
My
What?
favorites.
Yeah. I guess it depends more on the problem. But what is the first go-to technique in machine learning that you go to?
Well, I really like neural networks. That's I would say, as a general area, that's my favorite. Within neural network and deep learning, I would say anything. The less I have to do, the better. So any generative modeling, which is like when the neural network comes up with stuff by itself, or self-supervised, which is when the neural network thinks of its own labels to the data, or like anything unsupervised. So the neural network is its own boss, basically. Anything like that is what I'm interested in. I'd like to step away and let the computer do its thing as much as I can.
Okay, great. I guess there are a few terms being dropped over here, which I guess will be important for the later of the podcast. So let's try and define those. Could you define us these terms like neural networks, self-supervised and unsupervised? What do these things mean in the realms of computing and coding?
Oh, of course. So a neural network, you can think of it like a big a big matrix of numbers, and the data goes into this matrix and some kind of answer comes out. So if we go back to our dog and cat example, the dogs and cats go into the matrix and you get a one for a dog and zero for a cat.
Right.
And all a neural network is it takes the output of these values. It says whether it's correct or not, given the dog or cat input.
Right.
And it changes the matrix in such a way that it starts predicting the outputs as what we want.
Right.
So that's a neural network. It's just a big matrix of numbers.
Right. Okay. So when you say matrix, it's not the movie.
No.
It is more sort of, I guess a more general way to define a matrix would be just like a function. You essentially just give it, you want something out of it. This is a function that you don't have complete control over, but you know what the answer you want out of it. And you let the computer decide what sort of role it's going to play in sort of giving you the desired output to some extent.
Yeah, that's completely right. It's just a big function.
Right.
You control the inputs and you get the outputs, and you can control how you interpret the outputs, and you use that interpretation to change the function.
Right. Okay, great. So let's move on to supervised and self-supervised and unsupervised. What does that mean? Presumably you are in control supervision of the whole computer, right? This is not a Terminator situation that's happening over here.
Well, you'd be surprised, because someone got really interesting results with, like, how did it come up with this? But I'll define supervised first of all. So supervised is like our example just then, where we see the outputs and we know what they should be, and we compare it to the outputs that we get to where it should be, and we change the function so that it gets closer. So we're supervising the neural network. We're telling it what to do. Unsupervised is when nothing supervises a neural network. So it's coming up with answers by itself. So it could be making new pictures from noise. So you give it some noise and it comes up with its own dog and cat pictures, for example.
Right.
And a self-supervised, which is what I'm most interested in right now, is when the neural network comes up with its own labels for the pictures going in. So you don't tell it anything about the pictures. You just give it a bunch of images and it comes up with labels for each image.
Huh.
And somehow, given the what you tell it about the outputs, where they should be, it can cluster the images that are similar close together or far apart, the dissimilar ones. So it's supervising itself. Yeah.
I guess maybe one of the last questions for this segment right now is, so you're different. If it's very interesting that a computer can do all of these things together. And if a computer can really make these decisions of, oh, hey, here is a cluster of images that look very similar, without you telling me that this is what you're looking for, why is there a need for supervised machine learning if the computer can really do almost anything unsupervised?
That's a very good question. And it's because up until very recently, the last couple of years, the self-supervised and unsupervised algorithms weren't quite as good as the completely supervised algorithms. And that's changing now because there's such an abundance of data that you can train the algorithms on. So you need a lot more data for self-supervised and unsupervised learning.
Okay.
And I think that's the main thing. So if you don't have the data, do supervised. If you have lots of data, do self-supervised. Yeah.
I guess that makes sense. but I guess like more interesting results come out of unsupervised machine learning.
Yes.
Because I'm assuming... Exactly. Because I'm assuming a computer can think in larger dimensions than our mind can really comprehend.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like me and you, we're not going to look at a million galaxies and pick out patterns ourselves, but the computer can do that. And that's what makes it really cool.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Great. Okay. I guess this is a great place to stop for this segment. And when we come back, we're going to see sort of some of the work that you do with machine learning and astronomy together, and some of the things that we have worked on together as well. We'll be right back. All right, so that was 18 and a half minutes.
Okay.
I guess you could go into much deeper details if you'd like. To sort of keep the conversation going.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think now we're diving into the meat of the podcast kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll go into more detail. Yeah, I can do that.
How do you feel about this?
I think it's going good. Yeah.
Okay.
It's fun. Yeah. I've never done a podcast interview before, so it's interesting. Yeah.
It gets a lot of interest on the listener side of things because they get to sort of see what we're doing.
Yeah.
Sitting essentially in a room in front of our computers, really.
Yeah, that's the thing. Are you working from the office now?
No. Well, yes, no. I was, yeah. But because I'm leaving for Abu Dhabi in a week and a half, mm-hmm. in a week essentially, I decided to work from home to really limit.
Oh yeah.
Interaction. I do not want to catch COVID.
Cool.
6 days before leaving.
You gotta make sure, or maybe you do want to catch it there because you can get longer holiday.
Well, no, I'll have to. You gotta sit in a
hotel. Yeah.
Also, be in a hotel all day long, but I'll have to pay for that.
Do you?
Oh. Yeah. So they won't cover. So, I mean, technically, you have insurance. So once you go there, and if something like this happens,
yeah,
insurance will cover it, but you'll have to upfront the cost for stuff.
Yeah.
And I probably won't like that.
Yeah.
Because everything in Abu Dhabi is hellishly expensive for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get started.
Okay.
Reset the clock here. And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I have with me Mike Smith over here. And we're talking about machine learning. So, Mike, we've talked a lot about defining and sort of laying the big groundwork for what machine learning is. Let's really dive in deeper now. Why do we need machine learning today? Is it just like a random trend that popped up, and after which people realized, oh, this is so cool, everyone should be doing it? Or is it something like sort of came out of needs? Like, we have this problem and there's no other way to solve this apart from this unique set of algorithms and computers.
Okay. So I can talk a little bit about why deep learning is being such a trend right now.
Right.
So for a lot of years, it wasn't working all that well since it was invented in the 50s. I think Rosenblatt was the first guy who made an artificial neuron.
Right.
And the computes wasn't quite there until 2012 when Dan Sersan made the first the first modern on GPU architecture neural network.
Right.
And he applied his neural network to something called the ImageNet. It was like a competition, and he won the competition by such a large margin that everyone started looking at what he was doing.
Right.
Like, oh, hang on, maybe he's onto something here. Maybe these neural networks aren't so rubbish. Maybe we should have a look at them and like emulate what he's doing. And since that, as it was called DanNet, so since DanNet in 2012, everyone's been looking at neural networks, and like suddenly everything's exploded because you can do things with neural networks that you couldn't do before. Like, it was impossible before to like classify images to this scale, or to like do all this cool stuff you see with natural language processing, all these other things.
Right.
And there's this famous XKCD comic where it's like, there's this guy talking to his friend and he's like, oh, can you make this app for me? And the app, first of all, it takes a picture of a bird, and then it says where the bird is, and the guy says, oh, we can do that in like a day, we can decide where the bird is from the GPS coordinates. And then it says, now and tell me the breed of the bird, and the guy says, I'll need a research team in 5 years. And this comic was written in 2012, and it turns out like in 5 years time it works. All they needed was a research team in 5 years to get these things together, and a neural network is what makes that happen.
Wow, cool. Yeah. That's very interesting. All right, so you kind of sort of touched upon why, so what sort of started it, But in today's world, what kind of need do you see for machine learning? What are the places in science where machine learning is playing active and productive role?
So anywhere,
sure, we can all participate in hackathons and really,
of course,
solve random problems. But
really,
let's talk about some of the active roles that.
So anywhere where there's a big search space, so for example, astronomy, where you've got these mountains of data and you can't possibly go through it by hand with a team, even a team of human researchers wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
That's a good place for machine learning. Same with particle physics. If you're trying to find a specific particle in these massive Large Hadron Collider data sets, it's going to be very difficult to find that by hand. So it's useful to have these pattern matching algorithms, which is what machine learning is. It's just pattern matching to go through these big data sets and find these events that are rare. Other things as well is same with drugs and proteins. And if you want to do drug discovery, you have all these possible drugs that you have, but you want a very specific one that does this very specific thing to the body. And previously we'd have these wet labs, these biological labs with teams of biologists like testing these drugs and making sure they work. But you can just get a computer to use machine learning to simulate it, test the drug. And it's much faster and it's much safer because you're not using it on real participants anymore. It's a computer doing it now.
Yeah.
So anything like that, it's opened up all these possibilities that just weren't there before. And it's really exciting.
Right. I guess that makes sense in a lot of ways, because let's take the analogy of drug developing, because A, it's so relevant right now in the climate we live in, and we'll move to astronomy in a minute. But when you look at sort of chemical molecules and how they interact, and you've pointed out that there's so many different ways that it can interact, and rather than having 5 to 6 scientists sort of going through each interaction, which can be a tedious and a boring task, sort of having your computer do the job and then confirming it in a much smaller set of samples can be much efficient and move the field forward a lot quicker. And this is what we're seeing today in almost all fields, right? When you look at the number of refereed papers that come in that are using some sort of machine learning technique, it's sort of blown up in the past decade or so.
Oh yeah, I've got a very nice plot that's going to be in my thesis, and it's number of machine learning papers submitted to AstroPH, which is a preprint server for astronomy articles, and it just goes exponential since 2015. It rockets off into the distance.
Yeah. Right, and it's a very smooth. It's almost like it's very crass to say this, but it's almost like watching COVID cases blow up in a region, right? It's that's the kind of nature. It's like one person produces it and then 5 people read it.
Yeah.
It's almost an epidemiological model that happens with a one person does it, 5 people read it, they do the same thing, and then another 5 people read it kind of thing. And it's really gone to some extent out of hand. there's no need for traditional astronomers anymore. All right. So let's move to some astronomy now for the rest of this segment. We worked together on something called Pix2Prof. It's just a fancy name we gave to the software that you developed, Mike. Tell us a little bit more about Pix2Prof. Where does it fit in to the community? What is it? How does it work?
So Pix2Prof, it addresses a problem in astronomy. So in astronomy, it's useful to get these summary statistics of galaxies. And one of these statistics is something called a surface brightness profile.
Right. Or a light profile.
Or a light curve, a light profile.
Yeah. And the amount of light coming from the center of galaxy to the as a function of the center of galaxy going out. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the one. So it's just the light. The amount of light from the center going outwards. So it's by radius, how bright the galaxy is. And all this is a sequence of floats. But it takes a while to generate it because the algorithm that we were using at the time. It has several maps, so you had to like find the center of the galaxy. You had to make sure that the isotopes or the points where you measure the brightness were all lined up correctly.
Right.
And this needs a human to do it, which means it takes longer than it could do with an automated method.
Yeah, I could sort of pipe in over here that human was me doing it.
Yes.
and I can just set a baseline. Each galaxy would take me about 5 minutes to do. And we were planning on sort of making large databases of about 4,000 galaxies. And 5 times 4,000, it's about 20,000 minutes. That's a lot of time spent just looking at images and fitting sort of light profiles to them. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it would take Paul Nick 20,000 minutes to make these galaxies.
And whatever that is.
Yeah, whichever amount of hours that is, a lot of hours. And the idea is we could use machine learning to speed this up. We could take Nick out the loop and get a neural network, a NickNet, if you were, to do his job for this. And the neural network in question, it's like a captioning software for the galaxy. So if you imagine like a picture going in and a text caption coming out.
Right.
So you say you've got a picture of the galaxy and it says this galaxy is spiral arms or something. It's right. Along those lines. And we took that neural network and we said, instead of the caption, give it the light profile. So the light profile is the caption of this neural network. The neural network goes into it's the caption of this galaxy. The galaxy goes into the neural network, and what the neural network thinks would be its light profile is predicted. And this can happen really quickly because there's no longer any nick in the loop. There's no longer any manual steps going on here.
Right.
So we could do, I think it was about a galaxy every half a second.
Right. So just compare like 5 minutes to half a second. That's very fast.
Yes. This is around 100 times faster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Let's sort of break it down a little bit more over here. The first question that will pop into our user's mind is how does the computer know what the light profile should look like? Mm-hmm. Like, are there some starting points does it start on, or does it just randomly go in every possible direction and then sort of narrow down on a correct answer for the computer?
Yeah. So we had this big data set of galaxies and their light profiles. So we had a set of galaxies and a set of the light profiles that Nick made for us.
Yeah.
And we took this data set and we showed it to the neural network and we said, this is what a light profile looks like for this galaxy. And we just kept showing the neural network this stuff until it eventually learned what type of galaxy produces what type of light profile.
Right.
So to begin with, it was coming up with all crazy, crazy light profiles that didn't make any sense.
Right.
As it learned and as it like refined its predictions, they started to make more and more sense until they were roughly correct to what we were seeing with the human in the loop doing it.
Interesting. So this is sort of a technical term for this is the training set. So
yes,
let's start sort of diving deeper in on the training set itself. Of course, it was created by a human, and so there could two questions that pop up. One, how long does it take a computer to train itself? Does it depend on the size of the data? And what if the data is all wrong?
So assuming you have correct data, first of all, it depends what network you're using and what the problem is. If it's a more difficult problem, it will take longer. It depends on what computing hardware you have as well. If you've got like a great big machine, which I've got access to one of these at the moment, it wouldn't take much time at all. If you've just got a GPU like on your computer at home, it would take a while. So I would say it depends on the problem. You can't really say how long it would take to train it. But for this specific case, I remember it took around a week to train from start to finish.
Okay, and this is on the big computer?
This is on the big computer, yes. Wow. And that for me, that's a short time.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, maybe this is very important for our listeners when we say short amount of time. A week is really a short amount of time. In computing times, people will open up softwares like this, really. But that's because all of these things have been optimized to work perfectly. But when you're essentially starting from scratch, coming down to a week, imagining sort of all possibilities is quite fast, right?
Yeah, that's quite fast, especially because neural networks, they take ages to train. Yeah. And a lot of computing power, which is a problem with using electricity and all these other things. But
right.
Yeah, there's research into this on to how you can mitigate that. So hopefully that will come about.
Right.
But yeah, a week is a short amount of time. And this is assuming the data is correct. If the data doesn't make any sense,
the
neural network isn't going to learn anything useful. So we have to make sure, first of all, that the data makes sense. And that's where the human comes in to actually check the data. And that's where Nick came in to make sure it all was working before we started the training.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you could make the argument that you've not really removed the human from the machine learning, right? Because if the point is, and then this sort of brings us to the second question I asked, is if you still need a human to create, quote unquote, the correct data, then why have the computer in the first place, right? Because that seems like an extra step.
So the humans made the correct data, but once the data is made and once the network is trained, we can use the network to then make new data at a much faster rate than a human would. So we can still have the human do it, if you like, to actually make sure. Or you could just have a human looking at the outputs of the computer later on, which would be much less time than...
Right, okay.
The start to finish human doing it, yeah.
Okay, so how big does this correct data need to be? Can it be just 10 galaxies? Does it have to be 100,000 galaxies? We already sort of defined that for me to create one of these light curves, so to speak, would have taken 5 minutes. So how big does an optimal amount of training set
need? As always with deep learning, more is better. So the more we have, the better the algorithm is going to learn and do. As a minimum, I would say you want around 1,000 galaxies for a supervised problem that we had. I can't remember exactly how many we had. I think it was around that.
Yeah, we were about 1,600, if I'm not wrong, something.
Yeah, something around that, which was good enough to get a signal out and prove that it works so that other people can then go and take it and run with it.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about Astro DDPM in a minute, but for that one, it's like self-supervised generative learning stuff, you want a bunch more data.
Right.
So for the technique we're going to be talking about in a bit, I needed 300,000 galaxies, which is petabytes, or like, not petabytes, tens of terabytes of data. A lot. You need a lot.
Yeah. I can imagine that. Let's kind of dive into Astro DDPM. Tell us what Astro DDPM is. What does it do? And why does it need so much data to start with?
Yeah. So Astro DDPM, it's something called a generative neural network. So it's generating images that look like the training set. So here the training set is a lot of galaxies. And Astro DDPM is looking at all of its galaxies and trying to generate images that look like them, but aren't them. So it's something something similar to the galaxies going in. And the reason we want to do this is because it's useful for like generating maybe rare galaxies, like stuff we haven't seen so much of, and using them to train other neural networks or other machine learning methods. Or it can tell us something useful about the underlying training data. It's just useful to have this generative model. And we found that Astro DDPM could generate these galaxies, and they were indistinguishable from the training set. So it could generate the galaxies, and they looked exactly the same as what we were expecting them to look like, which is really cool. Yeah. And it took 300,000 galaxies to do that, and months of training.
This time. Right.
several months.
Month of training, and this is still on the big computer.
This is on the big computer, yeah.
Right. So it's still a lot of work to get these things going. So how do you determine with respect to Astro DDPM as to, oh, if I look at a galaxy, this is indistinguishable from an original or a real galaxy? Does a human on the other side just sit through and scroll through a bunch of images saying, oh, this is real, this is fake, this was real, this is fake? Or is there some sort of other technique that you use to sort of come down on the distinguishability of your data?
So there's a lot of techniques you can do here. The one you said, this is real, this is fake, that's actually a technique that people use. It's called the fool metric. Okay. So if you fool someone 50% of the time, that's a perfect thing because it's either real or fake.
Right.
And people do use that in deep learning papers. You can, in the paper, we actually had a big picture of real and fake galaxies shuffled up. And you couldn't tell which were real and which were fake. And we put that in the paper to say, look, they're indistinguishable from the training set. You can also do some statistics on it. So you can take some astronomical parameters like the size of the galaxies and their colors and how bright they are, and look at the distributions of a lot of them. Say we did 10,000, so we've got a histogram of 10,000 different galaxy sizes and compared the training set to the generated set, and we found that statistically they were the same. So we did that full metric, we did it a human looking at it, and we did it just with statistics, and we found in both cases that you couldn't tell the difference.
Right. Okay. Great. So let's sort of continue on to a future outlook of this. With both Pix2Prof and the Astro DDPM, how sensitive are they to the equipment being used? Once you, let's say, train a data set on a particular telescope, can you then apply it to any other telescope, or do you need to go back and retrain it because now suddenly you're using a different instrument?
So you wouldn't need to retrain it from scratch again. You can do something called fine tuning, which is when you take the trained neural network and you give it a little bit of new data. It doesn't need to be nearly as much as the previous data because it's already learned a bit about what data should look like.
Right.
And you can say, look at this new data, and change what you think or what you're producing given this new data. And then it goes away and does that, and it doesn't take nearly as much training time and nearly as much learning to do that at all. So yeah, for Astro DDPM and Pix2Prof, it won't work if you just plonk it in and say, use new data on it. But if you retrain it a little bit, it would work just fine. Yeah.
Right. So this sort of brings out the question, and the reason why I asked this for a reader specifically is just the amount of data that we're just sitting in expectations of, right? If you look at astronomy, we've been sort of throwing this term for a really long time, the big data astronomy era, where we're getting huge amounts of data. And Michael already talked about it. We're using about 300,000 galaxies to work with. But these new telescopes that are about to come online, such as the Vera C. Rubin telescope, which is in Chile, and Euclid, we're now looking at factor 100 times more data coming our way, like billions of galaxies. And of course, you do not want a poor Nick sitting on the other side of the telescope going through images and trying to get light profiles, right? And so in that case, sort of both Astro DDPM and Pix2Prof will be very, very important in a couple of years once Vera Rubin Observatory comes online and starts to spit out data, right?
Yeah, that's completely right. And that's why we're developing these techniques right now, so that we can be ready for when the big data comes and we can be like hit the ground running and find all this new cool stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I guess that sort of brings us towards the end of this section. We're going to take a break again, and we're going to come back and sort of talk a little bit more about some of the applications of machine learning on other than astronomy as well. So we'll be right back. So yeah, that was 23 minutes. That was good.
Oh, hey, nice. Sweet. We're on time. That's good.
We averaged out.
Yeah.
So in the next segment, I sort of put forward your work with medical physics, but we already talked a little bit about it already.
I've got some Earth observation stuff as well I can talk about.
Okay.
Which wasn't on the CV, but we're doing that. I can't go into so much detail about that, but we can have a chat about it.
But then that would come into what are you working on now?
Ah, yes. Okay, yeah. True.
So then the question is, do you want me to ask, do you want to go into deeper details with the medical physics question, or do you want me to?
Well, we can do, because I've been doing some stuff about the about drug discovery.
Okay.
Very early days, and that's off the ground just yet.
Okay, sure.
But yeah, we'll have a chat about that and see how it goes. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Cool. And then the last two questions are advice questions.
Yeah. Okay.
Be as descriptive as possible.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that.
In these advice questions, I guess. All right, let's get started.
All right.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. Once again, we are here with Mike Smith. And we're talking about machine learning, today's hot topics in computer science and being applied to other sciences. And Mike, you earlier hinted on a little bit the fact that you worked in medical physics as well and applied some of the machine learning techniques in medical physics. Sort of guide us through the journey of what you did with both heart disease and then drug development that you're doing right now.
Okay, so for my master's, I did the ECG classifier that I talked about, but we also did something called a magnetocardiogram classifier.
Yeah.
And a magnetocardiogram is those big magnets I talked about, and they measure the magnetic field of the heart.
Yeah.
So it produces a 2D array of the heart, a 2D picture of what's going on in your chest. And from that, you can extract these signals. So I took a neural network and I looked at the 2D pictures going through time. And we could use that to classify whether the patient was healthy or not. So that was quite neat.
Mm.
And then after I graduated, I worked with Jim Geach at Hertfordshire University, who's my supervisor at the moment.
Right.
And we worked on another heart disease classifier, this time with single photon emission tomography scans.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. So I'm just going to call them SPECT scans from now on. But this time a 3D image of the heart.
Yeah.
And from these scans, you can tell, like, you can see if there's clots in the heart, which are indicative of heart disease.
Right.
And you can take these scans and look at them, and you can find where the clots are. And you can say to the neural network, find where these clots are. And the interesting thing is, I never told the neural network where the clots are. I just said, this is a diseased heart or this is a healthy heart. And why do you think this is diseased or why do you think this is healthy? And you asked it, why do you think it's diseased? It highlighted the bits that were clotted.
Oh, wow.
Which was really neat. So it learned by itself. So I did that. I also did some stuff about finding where cells were in like a microscopic scan of cells. Just, you can apply machine learning to anything, it turns out, which is really cool. You just need enough data, which is... Yeah. Unfortunately, why I turned away from medical physics, because it's very difficult to get data in medical physics. There's a lot of red tape around acquiring the data, not so much the case in astrophysics, which is why I transitioned into that.
Yeah, I always like to say I'm very happy I work in astronomy, because medical ethics does not play as much a role. I mean, even when I'm visiting the doctor, I am more interested in the cool gadgets that I see around than the fact that I am actually not feeling well. I remember a few months ago, I went for an X-ray and I started talking to the technician about the machine rather than actually having my X-ray done. because it was just such a cool thing about being in an X-ray lab. So yeah, I guess that makes a lot more sense. All right. So you also sort of pointed out that you're working on some. I mean, I'm guessing there's only so much you can say about this, but you're also working on something with respect to drugs and machine learning.
Yeah.
So could you talk more about
I'm
that?
I'm trying to develop this program that tells us whether drugs, before we test them, whether they're going to be effective or not for the diseases that we want to use them on. So you would take a description of the drug, something called a smile string, and it's called a smile string because it's got lots of equals and brackets in it, so it looks like there's smiles in it. There's an acronym in there somewhere. So you would take these smile strings and feed them into the neural network. And the idea is the neural network would have a function that told you if the outputs are going to, if the drugs are going to be effective or not for the disease they're going to be treating or for the effect you want them to have on the body. And if this works, you'll be able to like bypass a lot of the wet lab testing, which would be really useful because it would make it much cheaper to produce these drugs, and it would be
and a lot faster as well.
A lot faster and a lot safer as well, because you won't have to test it on these poor animals and people.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm guessing with this is quite an active topic in science right now, given COVID. So does this current research that you have anything to do with sort of COVID vaccine development, or is it completely separate diseases? Can you tell us that, or do you have to keep that a secret?
It's completely separate.
Okay.
Unfortunately, because you would get more more interest if it was to do with COVID, of course.
Right.
But yeah, completely separate. But I assume you could use it as well to test new COVID vaccines, new vaccines in general.
Right.
But we haven't done that, so we're not sure. And we're not even sure if it's going to work yet. We're still very early days for this. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. What other projects are you working on, given the fact, just the versatility of machine learning? You can really apply it to anything. So are there other things that you're working on currently?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on some Earth observation stuff, so satellite imagery mostly. And I'm working on a crop classifier. So the idea is you would take these satellite images, and because all crops have a signal over time, these satellites revisit the same patch of ground every couple of days or so.
Yeah.
And you would take these pictures over time. You take a specific pixel, say the pixel has corn under it. So it's like, it's got corn underneath where that pixel is. It's normally a 20 by 20 meter square.
Yeah.
So that square is full of corn. And you would take a bunch of these pixels, put into the neural network. I'm saying put into the neural network a lot, but that's what you would do here. And the idea is you would use some kind of unsupervised learning algorithm.
Hmm.
And you would say, this is a signal for a plant, but I don't know what a plant is. Can you figure it out?
Hmm.
And the neural network would go away and figure it out, given a bunch and bunch of training data, a lot of it. And it would be able to do this without us knowing what the signal is for or anything about that patch of ground. Because I found that a lot of the time, any labeled data sets in Earth observation, they're incomplete at best. Like, they're not great. So the way to go here is not using a data set at all, just giving it data and saying, figure it out any way you can. So yeah, it's very versatile machine learning, and that's why I really enjoy it. You can take the same techniques and you can find connections with a bunch of different fields, and that's the really cool thing about it.
So with this crop classifier, what is generally the idea behind? Why do we need to look at satellite imagery and say that's corn and that's wheat and that's barley? Let's put it that way.
That's a good idea. That's a good point. So it's useful to predict what crop prices will be, this time next month. So if you can see a bunch of corn is getting ready to be harvested, you know the price is going to go down because there's going to be more corn on the market. So you can time what's going to happen. You can also use it for flood prediction. So if you know what signal the flood's water is, it's not just crops, it's anything, any pixel. If you know what signal water is, you can see this field's getting waterlogged. What if it breaks that bank? We should warn these people in this nearby town about the incoming floods. So you'd be able to use it for flood prevention, all kinds of stuff, any prediction stuff.
Right. So really, it's not, okay. Really, it's not so much as a crop classifier to really, you're building a warning system in some ways. It's not a as you pointed out, a prediction system, which can work for good or bad news events equally.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an anything classifier. And if we can classify anything, we can then take those classifications and what happens in the past as well, because we're going to have a time series of it, and predict what's going to happen in the near future.
Mm.
And if we can predict the future, what's going to happen on the ground, that's really neat, and that's really useful stuff.
Right. Cool. Great. So we're wrapping up this interview right now, Mike, and there are these two questions that I like to ask every scientist that we interview, and the first one is, given your expertise, what kind of developments are you looking forward to in the near future and also the long-term future with respect to machine learning? And this can be both codes and just the hardware that's coming through.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so hardware, obviously more GPUs. That's always really cool. Faster GPUs, so you can do more stuff. Something I'd be really interested in is the price of this equipment coming down. Because at the moment, all the interesting neural networks and deep learning techniques, they're the reserve of big either universities or big institutions and companies. And I kind of miss the days where you could do this research, this essential research from your bedroom, just as a solo researcher. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to get back to that at some point, because neural networks just keep getting bigger and bigger. I'd like them to get smaller and smaller and more efficient, which would be really neat.
Right. Oh.
But looking on the astro side, something that would be really cool is less hands-on stuff. So you would just give a machine learning system access to a giant survey of different galaxies, or literally just a blank field survey, if you will. And you would say, find out interesting things about this. And it would go away and find interesting things that you don't even know about.
Right. So before even we define what interesting really means.
We don't even define what interesting is. We just give it a server and say, have at it. And it finds cool stuff in that. That's what I'd really like. That would be really, really cool. Yeah, same with astro. Same with like any field. Just give it a bunch of data and say, find something. And we don't even know what it's going to find, but it's going to be cool when it finds it.
This is sounding more and more like the Terminator. I'm not going to lie. So, before I go to my next question, like, should we be scared?
No, not in the near future, I don't think. By 2040, maybe.
I guess your code does take into account that the computer shuts down once you unplug it, right?
Yes, it does. And that's happened a few times by accident. I've lost a lot of data that way. So you can turn it off, yeah.
that's great. okay, moving on to our last question. And this is sort of based on sort of our listeners, specifically our young listeners that listen to our podcast. What is one advice? You could really go multiple advice, really. But what is one advice that you would give your past self as a scientist before you started out doing research? What would you tell people who are just about the cusp of either starting to do research or go into undergrad for physics or computer sciences?
Yep. So I would say the main thing, for me anyway, was keeping an open mind. Because my background has been in physics this whole time. No computer science really proper computer science until I hit my fourth year of my undergraduate.
Right.
And then I started machine learning and I found out I liked it. But that if my dream was to do physics and I was always like physics, maybe I would have missed that.
Mm.
I kept an open mind and I take opportunities as they come. And I think that's the main bit of advice I would give people.
Mm.
Because I found that if you do that and you take things, if they're on the plate in front of you, instead of saying, I want to do this, this is all I can do, you branch out and do other things. That's the thing that's really helped me doing my research.
Right. Cool. Great. I think keeping an open mind as a scientist is always a great advice for sure. Certainly, I think this is a good advice independent of whether you're a scientist or not. So thank you, Mike, for coming here today and talking to us at the Fast Radio Burst. We hope you had a good time chatting with us. And yeah, we wish to see you sometime here in Kingston in the future.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. That's it from us. Thank you for listening to the Fast Radio Burst podcast. We will be back again with either another interesting scientist or another interesting topic through our podcast series. Thank you for listening. Bye. All right. I will stop recording.
Do you clap so that you can find out where the signal is? Ah, I see. I was like, why is he clapping?
Yeah, so basically what we do is when I clap, there's peaks, right? So you can just cut out clap to clap because they're like personal talks and things like that.
Yeah.
Take that. So we break and then we clap again. So there's useless stuff really for the podcast. And we cut that out and put in like an ad or something.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What do you advertise? Like?
No.
Caesar's pizza or something. Little Caesars, yeah.
No, not like that kind of ad, but like what's going on with physics department.